Tonight on Standing Room Only, Special Education Forum.
Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
On October 26th, the Indiana Coalition for Public Education held a panel discussion about meeting children's needs for special education in the Betsy DeVos era. The five panelists spoke about being advocates for their children, special education policy, and the effects of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's special education decisions. Today's show is a continuation of last week's episode of Standing Room Only.
Next is Dr. Wendy Marinsek. She's at IU. She's a clinical faculty in the area of special education at the Indiana University School of Education, and is co-director of a new program teaching all learners. It's called the TALL program, and I'm so excited. I supervise some students in that program, and I'm sure you're going to tell them a little bit of how that's different than the way maybe we were trained a few years ago. It's an undergraduate dual license special ed and elementary education teaching program, so you get both. She's been teaching courses on intervention and assessment for children with learning, attention, emotional, and behavioral disorders in Bloomington since 2000. And in addition, she has 20 years of experience in public education.
I'd like to say bravo to both of you. That was really wonderful and brave. Appreciate that. I've had 4 decades in special education. When I came to IU back in the 70s, the federal laws for special education were just starting to be reviewed and to be authorized to protect children with disabilities. At the time, I was young, really didn't know what I was doing. I knew I wanted to work in the field of mental health, but I really wasn't certain where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do or what I wanted to be when I grew up. And it was a couple great advisors that talked to me about the new special education training programs at IU that said this would be a great opportunity for you to work in schools with children because they're going to be coming out of the institutions into the schools. And that was really profound to me, thinking about that. That idea of children coming into schools for the first time, because I hadn't experienced that in my years of growing up in schools. You know, it was a group that would maybe come from the state school, that would come to some of our athletics and different types of things. So it was very appealing to me to think about the idea of bringing children in and working with them in our public schools. And I got into a fabulous program at IU. It was a program that was focused on what we'd say now, moderate to severe, but at the time our students were called trainable mentally retarded children. So we've changed a lot of our verbiage and a lot of our language, which has been better. And over the years, we've changed a number of things in these 4 decades that I've worked in special education, and they have all been to the benefit of children and families that have children with disabilities. The unfortunate part is in the last year, I'm hearing different kind of language. Instead of hearing language such as reauthorization and a new addendums to protect children, I'm hearing language such as rescinding. I'm hearing language such as diminishing services for children. I'm hearing language as rejecting children from coming into certain schools. And this is very troubling to me, to hear this type of language after, you know, 40 years of working in the field. So I think we need to pay attention and be very alert to what is going on currently in our political arena. With that said, I also wanted to talk a lot about the training of teachers. As Deb said, back in the day when we were trained, my student teaching was in Indianapolis, and I was in a full secluded school. All of my children had disabilities. There were no peer-related students in the school, or typical peers, we would say, for our children to have models. And we've moved from that place to a much better place of inclusion today, where our children really have access to the same curriculum, where they have access to typical peers, where they have many more services and much more support, and teams that work together to support them. So again, we've made a lot of great progress, but we do have to pay heed and pay attention to. So with that said, I also want to talk a little bit about special education and the role. As a special education teacher, I could pick any job. I could go anywhere I wanted to in the country. There have always been shortages in special education, so that is not new, and I'll be clear on that. However, let me first say, when the laws were passed, we needed special education teachers everywhere across the country. And so when my professor told me, he goes, you can pick wherever you want to go. And I said, I really hate the winter in Indiana, so I think I'll go to Houston, Texas. So I moved to Houston for 10 years and became familiar with the same laws in their state as we had in Indiana. And there's a federal umbrella with the laws, but within each state, they're interpreted a little bit differently. And so I had to learn the laws of Texas, plus I had to take Texas history, which was really not very interesting at the time. Again, we had a lot of reauthorizations. There was a lot of movement in special ed. We moved from what we called mainstreaming to full inclusion. And again, students were moving into a better position and access to curriculum. And we really had a lot of support for that. After 10 years of being in Texas, I decided to move to Germany in the Department of Defense. And at that point in time, I was evaluating students as a school psychologist. That was a very rewarding job for me, and we made a lot of changes in that area too. We used to base placements for students on IQ and some standards that were really strict parameters that didn't make a lot of sense. But now we look at the whole child, we look at their program, we look at their functioning, we look at their background. We take into account many more things than we used to and how we identify children that need services. And we have much more outreach and much more support for our schools in getting services to children. Not that it's any easier than it used to be, it's still hard to do this interdisciplinary type of work that we have to do. And this brings me to teachers and the training that they go through. You alluded to some of this. When teachers go into the field as a novice, even with all the training that we provide for them, the job is quite challenging. They have to have very sophisticated communication skills when they go into classrooms because they're working with veteran teachers who have been there for a while. So you're taking young women, and mostly women, and some young men, that are 22 years old, and they're having to come in and say, this student needs these services from you. Okay, this student needs this, this student needs this, and I'm responsible for the student because legally they are responsible. So it can be very challenging for new teachers to come into the field and have that type of sophistication and communication that they need to really interface with teachers and administrators. And oftentimes many of these people don't know exactly what they do. And so there are few special education teachers in the schools and many more general education teachers. So sometimes there's this feeling of isolation that these teachers feel as well. They'd like to collaborate with others, and you know, you can talk about this a little bit more clearly. But there are teams now that are working better together, and there are administrators that are more savvy about understanding the laws. And some of that has come honestly and out of interest, and some of that has come out of litigation, which maybe Janet will talk a little bit more about in special education, quite a bit involved with that. The other area I think that's problematic sometimes for special education teachers is something you also alluded to, and it's the knowledge base that they have to have. Not only do they need to understand curriculum, academics that the children need to learn, but they also need to understand the medical conditions that are involved with some of these cases. You listen to a parent talk about how complex that can be. They have to have a very good understanding of that. Many of these children are on medications. There's side effects sometimes from the medications. There's side effects or there's symptoms of different types of conditions that they need to be aware of, and they need to have a very good understanding of that, because when you're teaching, then you need to understand if a child's not paying attention, what is that about? What is the function of that behavior? Is it something that's related to that child's condition because they have ADHD? Or is it something that's related to a medication side effect? Or is it something related to something totally unrelated to either one of those, some fight that the child got into in the morning on the way to school? These are things that we need to consider all the time when we're looking at the functionality of our children. So you have to be almost like this CSI person, where you're putting up all these different things, these pieces of the puzzle that you refer to, and trying to understand what makes our kids tick and how, what's the best way to try to work with them and hook them into learning. So again, as new teachers coming into the field, that is a very challenging piece. The other part that we hear oftentimes with special education is the challenge of the paperwork. And this is a huge, probably it's been one of the number one complaints of special education teachers. They have federal paperwork, they have IEP services, and all of these protect our children, so we know they're very important. But to try to organize that while you're trying to organize your caseload and your students is quite challenging for those teachers. To find the time to do it, I can tell you many special education teachers work 24 hours a day. I don't know when they sleep, to be honest with you. Obviously, they do sleep. But it is quite challenging to get the paperwork done. And it's because they're federal documents, they have to be very careful on what they write on those papers and what they say. So they have to be very mindful of what they're doing when they're completing paperwork. The other part is role ambiguity is a problem for special education teachers. When they go into the field, many teachers go into a field hoping, you know, this is me and my classroom, and I have total control over this. As a special education teacher, that is not the case at all. You don't have control really over anything, you don't feel like, many times. You have a caseload of sometimes at this point in time 30 to 40 students that will need all kinds of services and all kinds of support. So you need to make sure that that's happening, and you're interfacing with so many different people. And you don't really feel that you have your grounding and ownership of many of these things. So I see Deb moving forward, so I'm gonna hit a few more things, because I feel that my role is to talk to you a little bit about why we're continuing to see some of these shortages in the field and what makes this role so challenging for our special educators who often leave within the first or second year of teaching. So finally, the last thing I was saying, I think I alluded to this a little bit, is some of the challenges with families and students. Families have great needs. They need a lot of support. They need to be understood, they need to be heard, they need a lot of individual interfacing, because they know the most about their children, and we need to be reaching out to them. Children sometimes are frustrated, or many times are frustrated, and they need supports. We need to help them, because we'll see behavioral issues, we'll see learning issues with them, and we need to have an understanding of how to engage them and hook them into learning and make learning and school fun. And when you don't learn well, and when you're frustrated, or if you have emotional problems, or you're struggling, school is not fun. And teachers have the big task of trying to bring these children in to enjoy their learning experience. So many more things I would love to tell you, but I'm going to wait. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I love what I do in training teachers. I have some of the best candidates in the world at IU. I'm very fortunate to get really wonderful students that are very passionate about being special educators. Thank you.
Wendy, will you tell them in one more minute about the difference in your TAL program and the way we used to do student teaching?
Okay, so the Teaching All Learner programs is a dual licensure program. And when we were trained really in a segregated way to work specifically with children with disabilities. We were not taught a great deal about the curriculum. It was really more about, as a specialist, how we would work with children with disabilities. If we dealt with curriculum, it was more related to technique and strategies versus working with how do we integrate children into general education, into the general world. Ultimately, that's where we wanted to go. But with the Teaching All Learner programs, I'm personally training teachers now to work with both general and special education and to work the continuum of schools. They work from general education all the way through to children who have intensive needs in school. Is that what you were referring to mostly?
Pretty much. The fact that they get two semesters of student teaching is different. When I went through, back in the dark ages, I did have what was called an endorsement. I had elementary ed and then an endorsement in special ed, and then I got my master's in special ed. So I still got both student teaching experiences, but crammed into one semester.
Yeah.
And now what you're doing is spreading it over the whole year.
Right. Which has really actually been new. And part of that is because we know that, and I'll go really quickly here, we know that if teachers are trained in the field, the retention rate is much higher. And so we have pushed at IU to have a year-long student teaching for our student teachers because we know that we need to keep them in the field. We don't need to just put them out there, but we need to keep them in the field. Our students need them.
Our fourth person is Paula T. She's the Regional Program Specialist for InSource, where she's worked for 5 years. However, she was first a client there in May of 2003, and through that association was able to more effectively advocate for her son.
First off, I don't know who knows what InSource is, but in 1979, when the special education laws were done federally, there was an understanding that it would be very confusing for parents to navigate the laws and to understand what was going on. So the law specifies that each state have a parent education network. In the state of Indiana, InSource has been that education network since 1979. I think we're the only state in the union that has had the same organization serving as a parent education network since the beginning of that. We have a number of individuals across the state that cover regions for InSource. I cover Lawrence, Monroe, Brown, Jackson, and Bartholomew counties. And what my job is to provide support to parents so that they can effectively advocate for their children. I can attend meetings with a parent if a parent is struggling with the process and feels a need for support. I can go with them. Primarily, I provide education and guidance. And I know a lot of you walk past my booth out there. I want to show you just quickly the pieces that I have. This is our parent handbook, and this is what I recommend everyone right off the bat when we first start talking, is that they read this. Sometimes I highlight specific sections that they need to read or others that they can skip for the time being if they're pressed for time. But this, the blue document, gives a basic understanding of the law and how it applies to their students. So it takes it from the letter of the law and takes it down to how do I use this and how is this going to look for me and my kid as we're doing this. The second one is navigating the course, and this one is done by the Department of Education. And their subtitle is a companion guide to Article 7. So what it is information that gets more to the points of law without actually sitting and reading the law. It covers a lot of the information that you need specifically. So it's kind of, if you're doing it sequentially, it would be the second one that you read. And then the last two, I know she's going to cover this much more, but this is a copy of Article 7, which is the actual law. And I didn't put as many of those out there. I do have more if I run out, but this is the law specifically. It's not the greatest reading. It's a good deal for insomnia, but the pieces that you need to know, you really need to know. So that they're covered here, and you need to find in there the pieces that apply to you and your child and become very familiar with those. The other piece that we have is the transition guide, and this is for students 14 and over. I try to tell folks that it doesn't replace the blue book or the green book, it's in addition to them. Once they turn 14, there are other issues there. But as I was listening to these guys, some of the things that came to mind is, you read in my bio that I became a client of InSource before I began to work for InSource. And in 2003, well, first of all, I've got a house full of kids. I've got seven kids. But at that point, I had one who was turning three and who had been very involved in First Steps and was transitioning to the developmental preschool. And I had no clue what I was doing. And so someone from First Steps recommended that I get in touch with InSource, which I did, and got my parent handbook and read it carefully and began to learn that process. Several years later, 5 years ago, I began to work for InSource. But probably the key piece for me as far as InSource is that nearly everyone, used to be everyone, now it's nearly everyone, that works for InSource has a child with a special need of one sort or another. So we all have been there, and we all understand the perspective of the parents that are calling us. Now, there are times that I get calls from parents that I think, oh my goodness, how does this person walk through their day? You know, they have some severe issues. And then I get calls from other parents who have children with very minor issues. But the reality is, whatever level of issue that parent is experiencing, it's a big issue for them, and it's a big issue for their kid, at whatever level it is. And as a parent, I think you can probably attest, you walk into a room and the whole team is there, and we're glad they're there. But you walk into a parent and there's one of you, maybe two of you, and there's eight people, nine people, whatever, on this team, and you just kind of want to hide a little bit because it's intense. And the intensity of you want the services for your kids and you want the team there, but you get the feeling at times like you get lost in the mix. And so what we attempt to do is to help families to understand that, number one, they're their child's first teacher. They understand their child as well or better than anybody else, and their input is valuable. We need the input and guidance from the schools, but the schools need to listen to the parents in that process as well, and to hear what the parents are saying about the child. So we try to emphasize to the parents that they're an active member of the team. They're an active member of the case conference, and that their input is valuable and as valuable as other members of the team. It's important too, though, that we work to try to strengthen the bonds between parents and school, because there are times when parents and schools disagree on how something should be handled. Those things are going to happen. Sometimes we're going to agree, sometimes we're going to disagree. But if we go in fighting or looking for a fight, we're not going to be able to keep the focus on the positive and on the growth that we need to for the children. So what we work really strongly on is helping parents to, number one, know what their rights are, number two, know how to present those rights. I think there's an entire chapter on the blue book, in the blue book, on how to communicate your issues, communicate the things that you're trying to say, and then how to work together as a team instead of finding a point of contention. They covered many of my things, so I'm not going to talk quite as long. I do want to let you know that my child that entered preschool in 2003, he was three, he didn't talk till he was 4 and a half. He had many, many delays. We're talking about therapies, he had them all. At one point I tried to get everybody together, figure out what everybody was doing, and this was before he entered public school. I was so confused at that point. He's now 17, he's a sophomore, and he's on track for a general diploma. So.
You've been listening to Special Education Forum on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to panelists discuss how to better advocate for special education in the Betsy DeVos era. We now return to the show with the next panelist talking about special education policy.
Last but not least, I introduce Janet Decker. She's assistant professor at IU, where she teaches school law to teachers, administrators, and law students. Her research comprises three intersecting strands. One, informing special education policy and practice. Two, increasing legal literacy. And three, examining discriminatory practices at charter schools. And she has been involved with four book projects and multiple articles, which we're going to be able to share some of those with you, especially if we get your email address out there. She's become interested in special education policy when she taught students with autism.
So before I go into the exciting world of policy, which I'm sure you're all really eager to hear about, I did just want to give you my perspective, because everyone comes from a different perspective. So I taught children with autism in a private school, and it was a private school for very wealthy families, and the children were getting some of the best intervention possible. I then was hired by an Indiana public school district to be a behavioral consultant, and really saw the inequities between the type of intervention that the students who I was teaching on the East Coast were getting versus students in a public district here, and also saw the adversarial nature that Paula was mentioning when there are disagreements and litigation happens, and saw that the focus got shifted away from the child and onto the dispute, and saw a problem with that. And that's when I decided to become a lawyer, not to be part of that adversarial process, but hopefully to try to learn more about policy, because as a teacher, I would hear about the federal law, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. I thought I could read, the Article 7 of the state law, that I read aspects of IDEA, but then I come to a case conference or IEP meetings and I wouldn't understand how my perspective of what was appropriate wasn't the school district's perspective of what was appropriate. And through going to law school, learned how very complicated it is. And so now I have an opportunity to be a professor and teach future teachers and administrators and future lawyers, but also research some of these issues. So I know that Deb mentioned the basic principles behind IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. I'll try not to use too many acronyms. But just to give you kind of the structure, so you can understand, I'm going to mostly talk to you about vouchers. But the structure, there's the public school district that absolutely has to follow the law, the federal law, the state law. Then there's charter schools, which are a type of public school that also have to follow the federal law and also can't discriminate against students with disabilities and exclude them from services. But then private schools, like the private school that I taught, at, they are not required to follow the IDEA, and so they don't have that requirement to follow all of the law. There might be certain discrimination laws that they might have to follow based on what they are exactly. I thought I'd give you, and I'll try to cut some of my comments short, and maybe I can answer them in comments, but some facts, some bad news, some good news, and then maybe some guidance. So when I thought about, like, what's the hottest topic when it comes to policy from an Indiana perspective, I really think special education vouchers are something that people should know about. In particular, there's a type of voucher called an education savings account, or an ESA. And those have been proposed in Indiana. They're growing across the country. In Indiana, they haven't been enacted, but most likely they'll be proposed again this year. And so they're a certain type of voucher for students with disabilities. And if you consider them as a voucher, and you look at the ones that are focused just for students with disabilities, it's a growing policy across the country. So across the country, there are 18 different special education voucher programs in 13 different states. And if you expand your definition of what a voucher is to tax credit and deduction programs, that number increases to over 24 of these policies that are designed just for students with disabilities. So the idea behind a voucher is where the public funding that would go to a public school district is instead going to a family to then use for private services, so typically for private school tuition. When there's been challenges to that, for instance, Arizona's voucher program was challenged, then education savings accounts, a type of voucher, were created. And the legal challenges against education savings accounts haven't been successful. They've been able to persist because, unlike how it was structured before for education savings accounts, the money is like a personal account for parents. So the idea that the money is being funneled to private institutions and perhaps to parochial schools isn't a strong connection, because the money is going to parents instead. So out of the fastest growing type of voucher is a special education voucher just for students with disabilities. And the growing type of those, the subset, are these education savings accounts. So there's six ESAs, or education savings accounts, currently, and five of the six are designed for students with disabilities particularly. So that's the facts. And then I don't know from the audience whether you want to hear the bad news or the good news first, but it will depend on your perspective of whether you think this policy movement is positive or not. I try to take the vantage point from the students and the families who I worked with and see the policy from their perspective and what works for students with disabilities. And so I'm going to start with the bad news. And when it comes to these voucher programs, parents oftentimes don't understand that when they select to participate in a voucher program, they're waiving all those rights, you know, not just the Indiana law, but the massive rights that people have fought for since the 70s and before, even for students with disabilities. And so a lot of times parents don't understand that that's a substitute, that they're waiving their rights. And not only as a society, they're waiving their child's rights, so the child isn't going to say so in the matter either. If the parent chooses a voucher program maybe to go to a private school for religious reasons and not necessarily for education reasons. When I did research in 2016 about the different special education voucher programs, when I looked at the different training and requirements, you know, they vary across the states, but 40% of them required the private schools or the recipients of the voucher monies, 40% of them didn't require any type of training for any kind of special education training. So no training at the voucher receiving schools for students with disabilities. And so what we're seeing across the country is that the different type of special education vouchers are kind of they're using students with disabilities as a poster child, as saying, if you don't support students with disabilities, then you know that's a problem. But the way to support students with disabilities is by supporting these voucher programs. And so some advocates are saying that that's wrong, to use children as poster children, and then to expand the voucher further to increase it to not just students with disabilities who might need some extra financial support or extra services, but then to grow to a variety of other students. So the ESAs that I was mentioning, the education savings accounts, the monies have expanded quite drastically. Parents can use those monies for college expenses. So some people are concerned that a parent would opt to save up for college instead of worry about intervention and education when the child is in the formative years. They can be used for homeschooling, for online classes, for tuition, for just a variety of services. And they're not just for students with disabilities, so also for students from families with a military background or from underperforming schools or siblings or children who are homeschooled. The proposal that has come through Indiana state legislature has also been for students who are not just students who might qualify for an IEP, an individual education program, but also students who qualify for Section 504s. And so that definition of disability is much more expansive. It might be a student who has a peanut allergy or has diabetes or a variety of other issues that they also could receive the vouchers. So it's a program that's expanding drastically. The other piece of bad news, I don't want to go into the good news, is just that the funding then is being taken from public school districts and being going to private institutions. So in 2016, there were about 150,000 students with disabilities participating in voucher programs and over $72 million spent. And this means so much more when you look at the funding for students with disabilities and how the federal law has required so much on public school districts, so many responsibilities that teachers, parents, and advocates and others have to navigate and are responsible for, but Congress has never fully funded IDEA, the federal law. In fact, the year that it was funded the most, and this is since 1975, the year that it was funded the highest was in 2005, and that was only 18% of what Congress had promised back in 1975. And currently, it's about 16% funded. So there's a lot of mandates, but there's not the funding behind it to support the training and support services there. So okay, now to some good news, and I have more bad news, but I'll go over that. So the good news when you think of these education savings accounts is that many have been proposed. It's a growing policy effort, but they also, many of them have failed. So not only in Indiana, but there's about eight or more ones that have. There's also been a federal one proposed, and I went to a conference on Capitol Hill this summer, and the federal lobbyists were from both sides, whether they thought it was a positive or a negative, both conceded that the federal voucher program was unlikely to pass for a variety of reasons. Another positive, the panel tonight has Betsy DeVos's name in it. Whether you like her or dislike her, she's definitely raising conversation around education policy. People are being aware, people are talking, people are attending to what's happening and scrutinizing reform efforts such as voucher programs. Also within the existing voucher programs, there's varying levels of the policy. So there, if a voucher program is inevitable, there's various things that advocates can do to ensure that the policy meets the needs of students with disabilities more. And then with a voucher, parents can always return to public schools if they want to regain their IDEA rights and for their children or for themselves. So I think I'm out of time at that point. So I'll save the guidance for later. Thank you.
Thank you. So we have 20 minutes or so left, and if we don't get to the question, you can still hand some up and you sign up for our emails. We will send these questions to our panelists, have them answer, and we'll make sure you get that information. What's your best guess as to the impact on students and teachers of the rescinding of those guidelines? And what's the most effective way to fight back, other than to join ICPE and help us advocate? But any ideas?
Well, I don't know if I wasn't here for all the conversation. I think there's a lot of guidelines that are being rescinded that are really concerning. But the ones that were just recently rescinded, there was a webinar yesterday, and there's been discussion in policy circles about how a lot of the guidelines that they rescinded were outdated guidelines that were duplicative, and even advocacy organizations such as the Council for Children with Exceptional Council for Exceptional Children has even said that we shouldn't be as alarmed about those 78 guidelines that were just rescinded. They're not recent guidelines. There's a lot of things that were passed promulgated during the Obama administration that aren't rescinded. So we want to be vigilant for sure, but it might not be as bad as we think.
Okay. Good. I'll quote you on that.
I would like to interject on that point that there are advocacy organizations at the national level who have staff members that are actively reading those 72 documents or whatever. For example, the National Down Syndrome Society has someone that's already done it and is on board and is actively answering questions online. So if you want someone who knows what they're doing around education policy and want to ask specific questions about specific documents that have been rescinded, that would be a good resource.
And what's the resource?
National Down Syndrome Society.
The National Down Syndrome Society, because they're going through these 72 with a fine tooth comb.
Okay. I know NSOURCE has someone doing that same thing. I don't know the results of it yet, but we do have someone who's sorting through those very carefully. I know the discussion the other day was that several of them are quite old, and that the recension of those might not have as great as impact. So we've got to kind of look at which ones are going to have an impact more.
But like she said, it is waking us up to pay attention. So this one, maybe Katie, you might want to start. How can parents of students with IEPs best support special education teachers?
The best relationships I have with parents are when we meet regularly. And now, as we talked about the fact that special education teachers do work a lot of hours, but that's something where technology helps a lot. I have parents who I email with regularly. I have parents who I text with regularly. And knowing what's going on in a kid's life is an incredible help to me. As you mentioned, a kid comes in and is having difficulty that morning. Why? Is it something to do with, in my age, the group I work with, hitting puberty? Is it something to do with medications? Or did something bad happen that morning? And communication with parents makes that so much easier to know when they say, yeah, he got upset because we ran out of Honey Nut Cheerios this morning and that was the end of the world. That's really helpful for me. However, I'm gonna say it's a two-way street. And definitely, as a parent, not only is communication good, but communication should be respectful of the teacher's time, but also you should expect communication back. It should go both ways.
Thank you. I have two questions about diplomas for special education students and the impact on students, the impact on the school's score, you know, how we get graded, and the impact for students after 12th grade. Anyone?
A lot of points in there.
I know. Just give us your input on any part of that.
Well, I think one of the things that is important is not to make a decision on diploma or non-diploma track too early. There are some schools, I cover a wide area, there are some schools that start discussing whether the child is going to be on diploma track or not as early as second, third grade. And we're like, wait, you know, we can't do that at this point. But I think oftentimes parents don't understand, number one, the implications of whether to go certificate or general or core 40. They go in with folks telling them your kid's got them on a core 40 track, and then realize that there's no way their child is going to be able to meet the standards of that diploma, and then the parents aren't given guidance where to go with that whole collection of thoughts. So I think sometimes things are approached way too soon, and then other times they're approached way too late. And so that's one of the things that we try to do with families is, as we're working with children, is try to at least broach the topic and get parents thinking what the options are. And I think the changes within Department of Education right now in restructuring the certificate of completion our, which will start actually, I think, the fall of next year. Is that right, Kathleen? We'll start the fall of next year, which puts some more meat on the bones of that certification. Are going to be real helpful to a lot of students who are, we run into a lot of students who are able to work through a lot of things but can't meet, say, the math component of the general education diploma. And then it's kind of like, well, just throwing up the hands and quitting and getting a certificate of completion, but seeing it as a fail. And where now I hope the certificate of completion isn't seen as a failure, it's an accomplishment, but it's a different type of accomplishment. And if we can get it to the point, which the state is looking at right now, of again making that certificate more meaningful and more meaty, that it will have a better place in the marketplace as far as employers looking and seeing what the student has accomplished.
This question is from a Fulbright scholar from India who's visited many schools and has noticed that there's so much focus put on graduating and grades, and wondering about the social emotional, the whole child, and how might special education really focus on that whole child. So whoever wants to answer.
I can probably address that with my experience working with students who had high-functioning autism and Asperger's. That's often the difficulty that we experience. So here they were, young adults, and they had had done maybe really well in the pure academics of the high school that they went to. So their math teacher is like, oh, they just did great at this, but, you know, couldn't quite get the word problems aspect of it, but my gosh, could do computations all day. You know, the home ec teacher might be okay, he's doing great at measuring things and making perfect ingredients and recipes, but you put him in a group and we're not getting the social element, because of course that comes with autism. And then they would graduate, and then what would they would discover, and parents would discover, is that while all those academics are great, they don't help you keep a job. They don't help you maintain friendships and relationships. And that's where I think important distinction to make is the concept of knowledge in a field versus knowledge of education. So a student in particular might go to all these different classes and have teachers who are knowledgeable in that field. But in reality, it's the special education teacher that is supposed to look at the whole child and supposed to go, okay, when we sit down and we talk about transition and we talk about when you transition outside of school, what kind of job do you want? Do you have the skills for that job? And the skills should include not just you can pass pre-calc, but the skills should include, can you have a conversation and can you understand what your boss will want from you when you have a job? So I think that's where you look at more than just the academics. You have to look at the soft skills, and really that falls back on special education teachers to look at that big picture with the parents.
Anyone else?
Well, and I was going to say, even in training teachers, we want to make sure that they have the skills and abilities to support children with disabilities in the content areas and all the areas that we possibly can provide from them. But to be successful in the field, I really feel very strongly about their own personal resilience and their ability to be versatile. And I integrate that into all my coursework and what I do, because I know that just giving those tools to get out there and do that is not going to sustain them in a number of the challenges that they're going to have. So I think it's really important at that level as well that we look at that affective domain, as you talk about, or the interpersonal and the resilience ability of all of our candidates and all of our students.
One other question sort of related to that is about how you address teaching these teachers about cultural competency, multicultural diversity that's being in the regular ed classrooms. They're doing it, but so if they're in inclusion, they're getting that. But any other way that is addressed?
Yeah, in our program, I can speak to our program particularly. I mean, there are several courses that we address this at IU with the general education and special education. But we also, in the field, we have a field experience at IPS schools for a semester where we want our students to be in numerous schools there and work with children in poverty, work with children of color. We feel the title of our program is Teaching All Learners, and I feel very strongly that I'm committed to our students teaching all learners, and so we have a lot of dialogue with that. Students talk, they bring their issues into a seminar, and we talk about those issues within the classroom of what's happening in their classrooms, how they're feeling about that. We also help to break some of the illusions they believe. I mean, they're going to be murdered in the school, or they're going to have guns. And we know that there's a violent world out there, and that is true. But many times after they leave these schools, I find many of my candidates are passionate about working in urban education, and I'm thrilled about that. So that's another way that we try to do that.
Also, all student teachers from Indiana University have to complete a portfolio called the EdTPA. And there are many questions in there that really address. They have to look at that makeup of the kids and the school, and how do they integrate what they know about kids and their own biases and all of that. How do they use that to teach those kids better? So it's kind of inherent in those big questions. So we have time for one last question, and maybe you all will want to say this. It's asking you to ask a question. So if Betsy DeVos were here, what kind of question would you want to ask her regarding special education? And it can't be in general, do you know what IDEA is? Do you call it IDEA? That's a given. Hopefully she's learned that we don't say IDEA. So anyone have a question for Betsy DeVos? Whether she can answer it or not. Of what concerns you most? What would you like to have answered? We're really putting them on the spot. Okay, did someone who wrote this in the audience have a question? Do any of you have a question? Yes. What do you want to ask Betsy DeVos?
Are you talking to me?
Yes.
Okay, I want to ask Betsy DeVos why she believes all charter schools are better than public schools, and I'm not sure she's attended one, nor have her children. So I think she has a false impression, but she's been put in a position where she's supposed to be supporting public schools, so why isn't she?
Mm-hmm. So the person in the audience, I'll just repeat it, wants to ask Betsy DeVos why she is so favorable towards charter schools, and has she really done much to compare public schools and charter schools? So thank you for coming, and Kathy's gonna kind of wrap this up and tell our direction.
I'd have a lot of things to say to Betsy DeVos if I'm from Michigan too.
I think I have one.
You have a question? All right, go for it.
I would like to know why she thinks that money is more important than the education of my child.
Very good. So it is very much all about the money. One thing I was thinking about with the education savings account, I don't know, how much that would be? Because I'm listening to the amount of services and people that go into a team that they're talking about. And if you were going to go somewhere with a debit card, which is what the model is for this bill that might come up in the Indiana State Legislature again, that was here last session, by the way, how much money was it? Do you remember?
$9,000. So it's a subsidy for wealthy families to be able to pay for their private education, because most private school tuitions that's not going to cover the whole tuition.
Right.
And that's how it is around the country.
But like Park Tutor up in Indianapolis is about $20,000 a year, I think. This attack on public education, Betsy DeVos has a lot of friends in our state legislature, and they are no longer defining, you know, their push for vouchers and charter school and school choice as better outcomes. Now it's only about personal choice. So we've gotten away from the idea that public education is part of the common good, essential to our democracy, and that we worked really hard to make sure that that included people of color, and women and men, and people who were poorer, and children with different abilities. And now, I have a friend who was testifying at the State House on this bill before they pulled it last session, and one of the legislators on our House Education Committee was basically implying that she could just put her child back in an institution if she was concerned about it. So this education savings account is a bill by the American Legislative Exchange Council, and if you don't know what that is, you really need to look it up, because they've written all the bills that have really made teachers' lives a lot harder and have been attacking public schools, because it's about a better product and it's about a competition. But you know, no child should be on the losing end of a competition for equal educational opportunity. And so the next attack that we need to be ready for is going to likely be an attack on special education. And these little cuts are a death by a thousand cuts. As funding goes away and somebody goes over and is wealthy and can take their money over here, the kids who don't have parents that can advocate for them sometimes, who are poor, who don't have a phone to text to their teacher about, or are working too much and can't get in there, those are the kids that are going to get the shortest end of the stick. And we need to care about all children, because they're all a part of the community and the world that we want our children to live in. If you would like to join us, we would really like to have you. The Indiana Coalition for Public Education will be sending out alerts on who to write, when to write it, what to say, and we have a special student rate of $15 to be a member. A first-year member can be $20 a year. If you feel really generous, you can do our $40 a year membership rate, and that money goes toward our brochures and toward, we have a lobbyist at the state level who gets in front of these legislators, and he's the one that gives us these detailed pieces of information about what's coming next. Because they have said that their desire is that it's like whack-a-mole. If they throw as many bills out there as fast as they can, we just can't possibly hit them on the head every time. But we're gonna try, because this is our children, and this is their future, and the future of our country. So please join me in congratulating these people for a wonderful job.
You've been listening to Special Education Forum on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to panelists talk about how to meet children's needs for special education under Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. The Indiana Coalition for Public Education held this panel discussion on October 26th at the Monroe County Public Library.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.